100 years after his birth, historians are still trying to put the presidency of John F. Kennedy into context. As we continue our series, 100 Years of JFK in Massachusetts, WBUR's David Boeri reports on how Kennedy's image has evolved since the day he died.
He was a young president, still in his 40s, when he was killed by an assassin's bullets. But President James Garfield was no Jack Kennedy. In death, Garfield was commemorated by a postage stamp and a couple of monuments, then engulfed in obscurity. For John Kennedy, on the other hand, the afterlife has been athletic. On his last day, according to historian Alan Brinkley, he woke up as a president, quote, with admirers and detractors, a man with a record, some of it good, some of it not.
By the evening of that day, he had become a legend, enshrouded in a fog of grief and posthumous adulation from which he has never fully emerged.
JFK's now been dead longer than he lived, and by general consensus of historians themselves, a definitive biography has eluded them. Not that they haven't tried to pin him down. The number of books written about John F. Kennedy surpasses 40,000. When it comes to the most written about people in world history, Kennedy keeps company with only Jesus Christ and Abraham Lincoln. How JFK went from history to memory, which is how we choose to remember history, and how that memory was shaped is the subject of Michael Hogan's new book, The Afterlife of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
It's just sheer tragedy, and becomes a more interesting story as time goes by and we learn more about his inner life and his private life and hers as well.
Central to Hogan's biography of the dead president is the widow Jackie. She became the memory maker and the guardian of the image that the First Lady and her husband had cultivated in the White House.
I call it the Kennedy brand, and they did very little to deviate from that image.
Image of devoted husband and father, robust athlete, cultured and charming progressive.
People who inspired Americans to believe in themselves, to have faith in themselves, to believe that all problems were solvable. And that was the image he projected that made Americans feel really good about themselves.
The Kennedys' careful image-making also involved concealing what they did not want people to see.
And they were very, very good at it. We don't hear about the kind of wild, almost fraternity-like parties they could have in the yellow room upstairs in the second floor of the White House. His affairs, her use of amphetamines, her smoking, her lavish expenditures on her costumes and wardrobes.
From the brutal, traumatic beginning of Kennedy's afterlife, Jackie became wartime defender, an architect of how her dead husband would be remembered. As portrayed in the recent Hollywood movie Jackie, she plans and directs his funeral to recall Lincoln's and Franklin Roosevelt's and puts Jack in their company.
There should be more horses, more soldiers, more crying, more cameras.
Already elevated to hero, the dead president was exalted as a knight of the Round Table 1 week later. Speaking to the political reporter and historian Theodore White, Jackie created the enduring image, indeed the brand of Kennedy and his place in the American mind. She pointedly recites the lyrics of what she told White was her husband's favorite song from the Broadway musical Camelot.
Don't let it be forgot that for one brief, shining moment, there was a Camelot.
Historians to this day operate under the anchor of that metaphor that equates 1,000 days of the Kennedy administration to our brightest history.
There won't be another Camelot. Not another Camelot.
Camelot is even in the title of a new book that ends before Kennedy becomes president. The Road to Camelot, by former longtime Boston Globe reporters Curtis Wilkie and Thomas Oliphant, chronicles Senator Kennedy's 5-year campaign for the White House. Oliphant calls Kennedy and the rookies who joined him pioneers.
Much of modern politics owes its birth to his campaign.
No one had ever used television as systematically as Kennedy did,
including those awful 30-second and 60-second commercials that we've all come to hate so much, the pioneer was John Kennedy.
He was an upstart who turned to primaries, not party leaders, and beat the bosses at the polls. His was the first winning grassroots campaign, and it would become the playbook, Oliphant says, studied in minute detail by the future campaigns of Barry Goldwater, Gene McCarthy, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama.
There is a straight line that runs from JFK to Donald Trump. And it's the idea of coming from the outside in. Kennedy wasn't the choice of his party. He wasn't beloved in the Democratic Party when he started running for president.
Much has been made of the imperious multimillionaire father, Joseph Kennedy. But Curtis Wilkie says he was surprised to find how independently Jack and his brother Bobby ran the campaign.
The old man furnished the money, but they disregarded virtually every idea, every recommendation that he came up with.
What also emerges from The Road to Camelot is an unflattering account of Kennedy's accommodation of Jim Crow-era Southern segregationists. Tom Oliphant.
He was somewhat embarrassed by his conduct. The difference between you and me is that Kennedy wanted to get elected president. As a result, we found that he was more than willing to do some things that you'd want to put a question mark after. And one of them was the relationships he developed with some really terrible people down there.
Oliphant and Wilkie found letters that Kennedy wrote to George Wallace, offering to help him campaign for governor of Alabama, where Wallace would later declare, "Segregation now, segregation forever." Kennedy spent an evening at the mansion of Mississippi governor and campaign supporter and segregationist J.P. Coleman, who blocked integration of the state university. The accommodation of segregationists was not going to be found in the first wave of biographies that followed Kennedy's assassination. The first historians out of the gate, says historian Michael Hogan, were the loyalists and White House aides, the ones to embed the image of Camelot. Even the loyalists would be screened, however. As defender and enforcer of the faith, Jackie Kennedy insisted on reading both manuscripts before publication.
She read it, she reviewed it, and she asked for changes, which they made. Imagine that.
Then came William Manchester and Death of a President, his famous history of the assassination. Kennedy herself had commissioned it.
She wanted to see it before it went into print. She didn't like a good chunk of it, demanded very extensive changes, which he refused to make, and she took him to court.
Next came the second wave of biography in the late 70s to early 90s, says Hogan.
There was a wave of revisionist literature, a group of historians, mostly left-wing or new left historians, who were very critical.
Writers Gary Wills and Seymour Hersh and others pulled back Camelot to portray a Cold War hawk who encouraged the arms race, provoked a missile crisis, launched the Bay of Pigs uprising in Cuba, and got us deeper in Vietnam, and was conservative in domestic issues. Now we are in a third wave, says Hogan, the post-revisionist phase. It includes Robert Dalek's acclaimed biography, An Unfinished Life.
The country has been engulfed in a kind of wave of nostalgia. And that wave of nostalgia has helped to sustain Kennedy's reputation. As Robert Dalek once said, Kennedy looks so good to us today because everything after him looks so bad.
LBJ and the war in Vietnam, Nixon and Watergate, the gridlock that plagued the Obama years. The full glow of Kennedy may be dimmer than it once was, Hogan observes, but the public has voted. Opinion polls routinely show Kennedy in the top 10 list of presidents. 4 million people visit his grave a year, a piece of art designed under the supervision of Jackie Kennedy. Kennedy is the voice of inspiration, even for people who were not alive when he was.
They began, I think, to look back to a moment, a nostalgic moment that is more ideal than real. When they thought they did feel good about themselves, when they had a leader they loved and liked and trusted and was represented everything that they believed in as Americans.
And until we find a substitute for that, says Michael Hogan, JFK will keep his hold of the American mind and memory. And you can expect still more books. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.